Hello, and thanks for listening to the podcast edition of Ordinary Philosophy. Here, you can listen to interviews and audio renditions of pieces published in Ordinary Philosophy, dedicated to philosophy in the public square and the history of ideas that change the world. For more about Ordinary Philosophy, to see the accompanying photo series for this account, and to discover the sources and inspiration for each piece, please visit ordinaryphilosophy.com. Ordinary Philosophy's website and podcast are independent and ad-free, and so depend on support from patrons and listeners like you. To find out more about how you can contribute to Ordinary Philosophy, please visit the subscribe, submit, and support page and donate today. And if you enjoy what you read and hear at Ordinary Philosophy, please share with those you believe will enjoy it too, and please take a moment to rate and review this podcast on iTunes. I'm Amy Cools, creator and editor of Ordinary Philosophy. Episode 47, Frederick Douglass, New Bedford, Massachusetts Sites. Fifth day, Thursday, March 24th. When I arrive at the old whaling town of New Bedford, Massachusetts, it's overcast and very chilly. I had so enjoyed the respite from the cold in New York City's balmy weather that I was already a little spoiled. But I'm wearing lots of wool and my shearling boots, so I think I'm prepared. I start with the New Bedford Whaling National Historical Park Visitor Center, run by the National Park Service. Several of the town's buildings of historical interest are also preserved by the National Park Service here, including one of particular interest for my journey today. The visitor center is housed in the old 3rd District Courthouse constructed in 1835, a handsome Greek Revival building. I'm assisted by the kind and knowledgeable Diane Altman Barraby, and when I describe the purpose of my trip, she immediately supplies me with information, advice, a map, some pamphlets about Frederick Douglass, the town's Underground Railroad and abolitionist history, which was a strong one, and another pamphlet about the 54th Regiment of the Union Army and an accompanying collection of cards, like baseball cards, with images and stories of some of the men involved. The 54th Regiment plays an important role in Douglass's life in many ways. More on that shortly. After discussing the history of New Bedford, especially history pertaining to my trip, Diane directs me to a nearby coffee shop and cafe, where I go to study the material she gave me, do some additional research following what we've discussed, and arrange my tour for the day. Tia Maria's is a sweet little Portuguese establishment and serves me a beautiful cafe mocha topped with a cookie. What a nice way to warm up. I'm here in New Bedford because the newly married Douglasses wanted a safer haven than New York City, which as we'd seen was not, at that time, exactly a secure or safe place for escaped slaves or black people in general. New Bedford was an abolitionist stronghold, and besides, being a seafaring town, Douglass expected it to be easy for him to get a good job in his trade as a ship's calker. The large population of free black people of that town, and their allies the Quakers, Unitarians, and others who believed strongly in universal human rights and dignity, were united and fierce in the defense of their freedom. Would-be fugitive slave catchers were loath to attempt captures here, since they were promptly driven out of town upon discovery, often accompanied by a good beating. I decide to tour my New Bedford sites in order of location rather than chronology for two main reasons. I don't have the luxury of extra time, so I need to travel efficiently without too much zigzagging around, and it's really, really cold, to which this California girl is not acclimated, so I don't want to stay outside for long wandering stretches. I'm diverted at the outset by Siemens Bethel, since I pass by it at the crest of Johnny Cake Hill. Charming name. On my way from my car to my first destination. This old clapboard church to my left is featured in Herman Melville's Moby Dick, so of course I'm interested. I've long loved Melville, and I read his short stories, especially Billy Budd, over and over again as a young girl. While connections other than New Bedford itself, where Melville signed up to work on the whaler Acushnet, and the fact that each wrote a story about a slave revolt on a ship never occurred to me, some writers have found many links between the lives and ideas of Douglass and Melville, as explained and described in the book Frederick Douglass and Herman Melville, Essays in Relation. I'm intrigued by this book, which I only just discovered through my research for this trip. I'll certainly return to it to give it a good read. You can find the link in the blog post. I begin with the 54th Regiment Massachusetts Volunteer Infantry Plaza on William Street between South 2nd Street and Acushnet Avenue. This is where men signed up to serve as soldiers in the 54th Regiment as the first black troops of the Union Army in March of 1863. Douglas was a fierce advocate for the right of black men to enlist and thought it not only their responsibility to fight for their own freedom, he thought it an invaluable tool for attaining better social standing and an opportunity to learn invaluable skills that a life of slavery often robbed them of. Two of the men to enlist in the 54th were the Douglas's own two sons, Lewis and Charles. Lewis saw combat with the 54th and was wounded in the assault on Fort Wagner in July 18th of that year. Charles fell ill and couldn't serve at the time, but he later became a sergeant in the 5th Massachusetts Cavalry. More on the 54th Regiment is coming up in another of my posts soon. Here I pause in my account of today's journey. As I mentioned in the tale of my day in Easton, I occasionally miss places or photo opportunities that I kick myself for afterwards. This happens nowhere else on this trip more than here in New Bedford. In this case, I'm particularly hard-pressed for time, and to be honest, more than a little distracted by the cold. Turns out I've way underestimated the time I'd need here. So I'm going to do something a little differently for this day's account. I'll let you know when I'm telling you about a place that I discover in my fact-checking and editing for the account of this day's journey that I overlook or don't photograph adequately at the time. I'm doing this so if you want to use this account as a guide for your own Douglas trip here, you won't miss anything important like I did. Where I should go next, but miss though I've marked it on my map, as my friend Alex likes to say, derp. It's a little farther west on William Street, just past Purchase Street, where there's a plaque commemorating Liberty Hall. The original hall burned down in October 1854 and burned so hotly it melted the bell. The plaque contains a piece of its twisted metal. Douglas first heard William Lloyd Garrison speak at this hall in May or June of 1839. Garrison preached that, quote, "prejudice against color was rebellion against God, because all manner of sectarianism and prejudice went against God's will that everyone be united in one body in Christ's kingdom." Douglas was enthralled by this, read every issue of the Liberator enthusiastically, and attended every anti-slavery meeting held in this and nearby towns. He returned to Liberty Hall many times as a speaker himself over the next two decades in the 1840s and 50s. From the 54th Regiment Plaza, I continue west on William very briefly, then head up Acushnet Avenue to its north end. This street ends rather abruptly. Though it had once continued north for quite a while, it was raised at some point, likely to make way for the freeway that runs there. It used to be Ray Street, where Douglas and Anna moved to a house at number 111. Their family was growing, and they needed more space. The street there, and their third house in New Bedford, used to be closer to the wharves where Douglas worked for a time. Acushnet becomes Frederick Douglass Way, north of Elm Street. Diane at the National Park Service told me that I would find a street up this way named Frederick Douglass Way. She wishes that either a grand or more main street was named after him, or that this street was more decorative and well landscaped. I think it's fitting that this street be named for Douglas since he once lived here, so I hope for my part it's her second wish that comes true. From Frederick Douglass Way, I head straight east on Elm all the way to the corner of Elm and County Streets. Diane at the National Park Service Visitor Center identified this as the Old Methodist Church, which is no longer active at this site. It's currently up for sale. The engraving in one of the pointed arches in the center front of the bell tower notes that it was built in 1858, 20 years after Douglas would have begun attending. This may be then a new location, or it may have been rebuilt on this original site. Douglas did specifically refer to its being on Elm Street. Anna and Frederick Douglass were seeking religious community and comfort and hadn't yet fully realized the degree to which the mainstream Methodist Church, the religion of Douglass's youth, was a powerful supporter of slavery. Its ministers taught slaves that their salvation was to be attained through obedience to the worldly masters the Lord had placed over them, that their virtue was to be found in submission and hard work, and that their reward was to be in heaven rather than on earth. Unfortunately, many religious sects throughout history have used this tactic to exploit the poor and oppressed, teaching them that resignation to their plight is a virtue and a sure ticket to a better life in the hereafter, thereby avoiding the necessity and responsibility of making life on earth a happy and just one for all. In addition, the segregation of black people into the back of the church, serving them communion only after the whites had been served, disenchanted Douglas, and he promptly left, never to return. After all, as Douglas believed, the quality of a faith is revealed in the teachings of its ministers and in the beliefs and behavior of its congregation, especially in matters of justice and kindness to one's fellow human beings. He later joined a small faith community called the Zion Methodists, not only as a congregant, but as a licensed preacher. There is a church building that housed the Frederick Douglass Memorial African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church, no longer extant, at William and 8th, but it's uncertain whether it's a continuation of Douglass's congregation, though it was named for him. Then I head south down 8th Street, turn left on Union, and stop at 7th. There were two locations of interest in the life of Douglass here. One, on the southeast corner of Union and 7th, once stood the house of the Peabodys at 174 Union Street, about where the gray house is now. You can see the photo in the website. This is where Douglass picked up his first odd job here when Mrs. Peabody paid him $2 silver to put away a load of coal. This seemingly insignificant moment in a life felt very significant to the newly escaped Douglass, because it was the first money he ever earned that no one at that moment had the right or the inclination to take from him. It was one small job for a man, but one huge step in feeling like a free one. Also on Union and 7th, where there's a parking lot now on the north side of the street, across from where 7th begins, lived a man, or rather two men, named Joseph Ricketson. One of the two men Douglass named in his narrative, who picked up the newly married Douglasses when they arrived at Newport and took him to New Bedford, was Joseph Ricketson, probably referring to Senior, which implies, of course, there's also a Junior. The Ricketson house was a busy and particularly well-documented stop on the Underground Railroad. Then, Joseph Ricketson Sr. and the Douglasses would have taken the same route as I do now, assuming they stopped at his house first, heading south on 7th Street to Nathan and Polly Johnson's house at number 21. This is the first home where Douglas and Anna lived together, from the day they arrived here on September 17, 1838, until they moved into their first home in 1839. It's the only New Bedford home of the Douglasses still standing. Nathan and Polly Johnson were an inspiration to the Douglasses, a free, successful black couple who spent much of their time and money to help their people achieve the same. Actually, to be perfectly accurate, it was another pair of Johnsons, newly married Johnsons, who arrived here, since the former Frederick Bailey, aka Douglas, had renamed himself Frederick Johnson, making himself and Anna two more of the already too many Johnsons in the town. Most of the escaped slaves here had taken the same last name, in a friendly but overdone tribute. Nathan Johnson suggested the surname Douglas instead, after a hero in the Sir Walter Scott novel he was reading at the time, and Frederick Bailey, then Frederick Johnson, finally Frederick Douglass, accepted. Then, as I'm getting colder by the minute and hardly able to move my fingers, the wind chill has pushed the feels-like temperature down at this point to near freezing, I return to my car and drive to 185 MacArthur Drive near Leonard's Pier. This is the site of New Bedford's first whale oil refinery, built in 1838. In his autobiographies, Douglass wrote of visiting the wharves to find work, described the granite warehouses there, told of loading casks of oil onto ships, and said he worked for a time in an oil refinery in the south of the city for the same Joseph Ricketson just spoken of earlier. It would make sense that this is the same oil refinery, since it is indeed south of Old New Bedford, where all the sites visited today were, and the year of construction is early enough. If it isn't Rickardson's refinery, it could still be one of the ones Douglas delivered casks of oil to the ships from. And as you can see, it is, as he described, made of granite. Douglas was amazed at the level of social equality black people enjoyed here, with its integrated schools and many other institutions, but there was still segregation in many of the public buildings and competition and prejudice among working people. It was for the same reason that caused Douglas's bad experience working on the docks, especially at Gardner's Shipyard when he was still enslaved in Fells Point, because free whites had to compete for wages with black workers who would accept lower wages and therefore drive them down. In the end, Douglas couldn't find a good job as a calker here, so he worked as a common laborer on the docks, in perhaps this oil refinery, and at a brass foundry, among other places, averaging about $1 a day instead of the $2 he could earn as a calker. Though he was poor and worked long hours, which, as he said, was not at all conducive to mental improvement for the lack of time, he obtained a free subscription to Garrison's The Liberator, which led him to the aforementioned Garrison's talk at Liberty Hall, attended as many abolitionist meetings as he could, and continued to educate himself. As he became more informed, he became a more passionate believer in the cause of human rights. I head a little north among the piers, and stop for a bit to look across the water in the general direction of Nantucket. The ferries don't run there until later in April, so even if I had time, I couldn't go anyway. On August 11, 1841, Douglas was invited to tell the attendees of his experience as a slave at a large anti-slavery convention there at Athenaeum Hall. Abolitionist William Coffin had overheard him talking with friends in, quote, a little schoolhouse on 2nd Street, which, though scouring all the sources I can find up to this point, I can't find a location for, and was so impressed by his eloquent style of speaking, he was sure the convention would be too. The schoolhouse was likely one of the places where the Zion Methodists met, for whom Douglas preached. Douglas first met William Lloyd Garrison at this convention at Athenaeum Hall, in person, following his talk. As you remember, he had already heard him speak at Liberty Hall, and as Douglas's telling of his slave experiences was so effective, he was solicited by another abolitionist leader, John Collins, to become a member and speaker of the Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society. Thus began Douglas's lifetime career as a human rights activist. The last site I visit today is where Frederick and Anna Douglas's first home used to stand at 157 Elm Street. I had actually passed by it earlier, on my way from Frederick Douglass Way to the old Elm Street Methodist Church, as I had had it on my list and in my notes, but not on my map. Derp number two. If the street numbers haven't changed, then it would have been on or near the site of a large parking lot on the north side of Elm, across from a house at address 160. There's not much left in the way of old buildings on this part of the street, so I go up a little ways toward the Methodist Church, stopping at 8th to photograph some of the houses on Elm, but most of them still look too new to date to the Douglas's time there. Then as I head around the corner on 8th, I spot a little street that runs one over and parallel to Elm, named Mechanics Lane, where most of the houses look of the right vintage, on a cobblestone street. I draw nearer to the houses, and sure enough, their dates of original construction in the 1830s are proudly and prominently displayed on the front of the houses. So by looking at this street, we can get a good idea of what the Douglas' neighborhoods looked like when they lived here. The Zion Methodist Church that the Douglases used to attend may also have stood at the corner of 8th and Mechanics, about where I'm standing as I spot the street, though again, that's uncertain. The congregation met at various places around the town, since they had no permanent place of worship early on. Thus ends my account of my day in New Bedford, a delightful and interesting day, even if a bit chilly. I need to skedaddle to meet my host in time at the end of my drive to my next destination. So stay tuned for the next episode. And by the way, here's another site that I missed, but that you may wish to see if you're there. There's a small Frederick Douglass monument on the front lawn of City Hall at 133 William Street, near Mechanic Street. I don't stop there since it's not on my list of sites directly associated with Douglass's life, and as I mentioned, I'm running late and freezing cold, so I don't linger. But it's a very handsome building and a nice monument to visit. Again, as always, thanks for listening.